GradCast, the official radio show and podcast of the Society of Graduate Students here at Western University. Today, we are very excited to do our first hashtag BookCast podcast. So this is our new book club where we read a book that is sort of university, research, London related, something that fits into that category. And so I will introduce our hosts that we have here today. So this is a subset of the BookCast club at GradCast. So I am Amelie Hutchinson.
I'm Scott Walters.
I'm Mark Ambrosio.
I'm Garth Casborn.
And I'm Megan Vole.
And we are going to be the ones leading you through our discussion of this book. So I will hand it over to Scott, who brought this book to our attention, and he's going to be introducing it a little bit and kicking off the discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you, Amelie. I came to attention of this book by Elif Bataman, which is called The Idiot, because it was given to me as a Christmas present this year by my girlfriend's father. So I thought it would be very cool because basically, very briefly, it takes place in the late 90s on Harvard University campus for most of it, with the protagonist is a freshman undergrad student there trying to navigate life. We'll talk more about the plot content as things go along, but in general, this course is her trying to find her way. She signed up for various programs that she wants to be a writer. She takes Russian as a class, and eventually she meets someone who she becomes smitten with. She ends up doing a summer program. It's generally 1 year in the life of a Harvard undergraduate, and the book is broken apart into parts that represent the seasons of the year. So I chose the book. So generally, for those who aren't aware, for book clubs, usually that person, they're not in charge or anything like that, but they try to come up with questions, or at least just lead the question discussion. So that's just what I'll be doing for us here today. So my first question for everybody is, why do we think that the book is called The Idiot?
That's a really good question, Scott. I think the best explanation I can come up with is, I think there are times when, you know, you've had a long day and maybe you had meetings or you spoke with friends, and then you think to yourself, why the heck did I do or say that? I'm such an idiot. And so that's about the only thing I can think of. I think there are a few OG moments in the novel where the protagonist is like, why did I do this? Why did I do that? I think that's the only, I do not see any direct connection to Dostoevsky's classic work, The Idiot, but I could be wrong.
I would agree with that. I don't think there's any, I actually picked up Dostoevsky as part of preparing for this, and I've read about half of it. I don't see any connection plot-wise, character-wise, any, I mean, I think it is a homage. I think Batuman really did study Russian literature, and I think really admires Dostoevsky, mm-hmm. but I don't think... Mm-hmm. there's any connection at that level. But I think this is just, it's a Bildungsroman. It's a coming-of-age story. So I think The Idiot is just the somebody in their formative years doing really stupid things that they regret later on, but is sort of part of growing up. And I think also this, at least, two of us have an edition of the book with, I'm going to display my geological ignorance here, but it's maybe a piece of granite on the cover that's just unshapen, rough-hewn, and I think that's supposed to sort of represent she hasn't been shaped yet. She's
just a piece of rock.
A rock. No, I didn't. Despite having an English degree, I did not. I've never read Dostoevsky. I've never touched Russian literature. And for me, the reason why I thought the book was called The Idiot was because the main character, the plot, there were a lot of references to different metaphorical means of one being an idiot, whether that be the main character's choices, the idea of going to Harvard, this elite, very illustrious institution, and then the idiocy that comes with, as Garth said, a coming-of-age story and growing up and getting older. So I thought there was a very metaphorical play on words, and I think, as we might get into, the reader themselves being a bit of an idiot as they go through the novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was one scene near the end of the book where the main character is called an idiot by just a random neighborhood dad. Because I remember, like, she was, like, going by and he just called her, like, the idiot. And then I think that probably became the title, too, for all the reasons that you said. But because when you go to Harvard, like, you think you're really smart. And I think that the main character thinks that she's really smart. And then at the end you realize, oh, I'm not as smart as I think I was, or looking back, because this book was written kind of as looking back at that time, and you can be like, oh yes, I was an idiot.
Yeah, I agree with everything everybody said. You know, I think, speaking to the Harvard part, I think the homage in the name to the great novel of The Idiot, you know, that's a piece of literature that's thought of as kind of like high-minded, so to speak, by a lot of people, right? And so I think that links to the Harvard, but I think the whole idea for me was, no matter, you know, people at Harvard, people generally will think of it, whether you're going to Harvard or Oxford or Cambridge, it's like, oh, these people are really smart, they're really prepared, they're the best of the best, but they're still kids. And, you know, everybody who's young can make really idiotic choices. And Garth, I thought it was interesting what you said about, you know, looking back and this, I was an idiot because it's written, you know, in the past, and I regret this. But I'm not sure if I felt like a feeling of regret in the novel as much as like out and out, I'm being dumb throughout the story sort of thing. And that's not to pick on what you said, Garth, but I think it, for me, when it says The Idiot, I think it's trying to connect to everybody like, hey, it's okay. We're all idiots. We were all idiots once.
I think so. And I think part of, and Garth, you spoke about the coming of age aspect and how sometimes when people are in their early adulthood, they may do strange and wonderful things. And but I think also part of being, I don't know, part of being young may also be having a certain unease with yourself and not being quite at home in your own body yet. And then, you know, you feel like you did something idiotic and you know, you wear it for the rest of the week. And sometimes when you get older, you're like, oh, okay, cool. Well, I just made a fool of myself, but that's okay. I make a fool of myself every day, so I'm not too worried about it. And so I think, yes, I think it's coming of age, but I don't think too much. I see your point, Scott, but I don't think the protagonist is necessarily looking back and saying, I was such an idiot, but more that was maybe her sentiment at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost like the author, maybe, rather than the protagonist
yes.
herself.
Yes.
Yeah, because this is I forgot to mention, listeners, but the the protagonist, the author, it's not an autobiography, but it's semi-autobiographical. As Garth mentioned, she studied Russian literature. She also went to Ivy League. I think she went to Harvard, mm-hmm. actually. Yeah, so, and I know also with the Russian that we're speaking of, because we alluded to that, there was the Russian language in there, and one other piece of information is that there is a Russian language class she takes where that comes up quite a bit in the book. And this was based off of actual type of format of Russian class that she took herself. So this was one way in which it was emulating her actual real life. But before we get into any of that, Emily a second ago alluded to it being sort of a historical context. So like I mentioned, this takes place in the 90s. And when you read the author's note at the end and the acknowledgments, she talks about how she started writing this book like right after that period of her life, got stagnated, walked away, and then later in like 2016 or 17 came back to it, and the way she put it was she discovered it had become a historical novel because there was a big paradigm shift between the 90s with 9/11 and everything else and coming to now. So I was hoping people could maybe speak to how they felt about the differences that from what we see now to how we felt when we were reading the book and what we saw in the book.
Now, Scott, I just want to add to that
before
we get into that. There are two people, at least, who remember, let's say, for a benchmark, 9/11 very clearly,
mm-hmm.
versus two other people, myself and Amelie, mm-hmm. who were very, very young children at the time.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to be a range of questions, of answers because of that in and of itself.
Yes. Maybe. So I'm one of the two that does not remember 9/11 whatsoever. I was very young. And so I also don't obviously remember any of the 90s. So I didn't experience nostalgia when I was reading
sure.
this. I kind of read this as like, oh, this is what it was like to have email for the first time and like have to go to a specific computer to check your email and to not always be able to communicate with your friends when you're away for the summer, for example. So it was interesting to me to like look through the eyes of someone who was experiencing that, but I didn't have any specific feelings of like, oh yeah, I remember that. It was more like, uh-huh, so that's how it was.
For myself as well, like, it was the email, like this idea of like looking at how the novelty of email through the main character Celine's eyes, and mm-hmm. generally as an undergrad, but also when she was traveling or going out in the city, there were so many allusions to telephone booths mm-hmm. and boxes, and like those aren't a thing anymore. We don't
know
that you have cell phones, you have smartphones. So it was really kind of a glimpse into what 90s life, which though I was alive for part of it, I don't actually have a great memory of, or didn't really live in that sense, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So I also didn't kind of feel this nostalgia, but it was, as Scott mentioned, a historical account in a sense. Yeah.
Garth, do you?
Well, I sort of fall between the two,
yes.
Age, two age groups. So I remember email, well, internet and email becoming a thing. And partly my father works in computers, so we tended to have these technologies a little bit before my classmates. So I sort of remember those things. But I mean, I was in elementary school, so it's completely divorced in my memory from the college or mm-hmm. university experience. So it's sort of like, I didn't really see myself in it, but I could sort of relate to the two different things. But for me, they were two completely separate
right.
sets mm-hmm. of memories, sort of the internet thing and the university itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the nostalgia factor hit me immediately on page one. I didn't know what email was until I got to college, which makes sense because it was, people weren't emailing, like, if anything, it was thought to be odd. Like, if you said you were emailing your friends, like, why? Like, you know, because, like, that's kind of strange, you know what I mean? Like, that's, like, you're, okay, you're a bit of a geek. And, yeah, because it really came up in a formal educational setting. Like, you know, like, as an example, I remember in my undergraduate receiving a notice from the university, but being sent by email and being so frustrated. I thought, well, if they want us to know about this, why do they send it by email? Like, this makes absolutely no sense. And professors encouraging, this is interesting, professors encouraging students to check their emails, and students were like, why? Like, and you're here and we're here, and if you have something to say, just say it. And so kind of interesting. And a lot happened, 9/11, because it's hard to pick, like, earlier, Megan, you just mentioned smartphones. Mm-hmm. Now, so smartphones, as we know them today, have not been around that long. You know, because think, for example, Obama was famous for always having a BlackBerry around
him.
Yeah. So smartphones, as we know them, are more like 2014, 15 onward.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not necessarily, like, a world without smartphones is, like, that was the case throughout the 2000s. But, you know, like, there was, because, you know, I can remember using, for example, a payphone, like, circa 2005. Mm-hmm. Just because, you know, not everybody had. And then those who had cell phones, it was a flip phone. And these things came. It's hard to pick a point where suddenly the world changed as want as we are to do that. And if we are going to do that, the people tend to pick 9/11. The interesting thing about 9/11 is prior to 9/11, so you had the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, and then, you know, throughout, since the Second World War, we've been at war, not actively, but more indirectly with the Soviet Union. And then suddenly there's peace, and people are talking about peace as if it's just almost like the end of the Second World War, because, you know, the threat of nuclear war had passed.
Maybe.
You know, and then
the imminent feeling within our souls.
Feeling. Yes. Yeah. Well, talking more about the mentality rather than the reality, and there's a sense of peace. And then 9/11 maybe changed some of that, and then some of the recent Russian-U.S. tensions have been relatively recent. And so in the 90s, you had that sense of peace. And it was sort of like, so yeah, some of the changes came later on. But yeah, the 90s themselves were like sort of like the last hurrah of the analog age. If you wanted to communicate with somebody, it was by phone, or you physically went to see them, or you wrote them a letter.
Right. I agree. And I brought up 9/11. I'm glad I did, but just as an example, but I agree with you. And as we see through a lot of these talks, we really identified in different ways with the telephone, right? And I think that was it. And like Mark said, maybe a bit less about the smartphone, but the world started to really shrink at that time period. And that's what I got the feeling from the book when I thought of it, when I got nostalgia. I'm about Mark's age. And so I had the same gut reaction with the first page, like, oh yeah, email. Haha. I knew about email. Our family knew about email, but we didn't actively use it. And I had that experience. But yeah, it's this feeling of being in a different time. And it was a very special different time. And she's having to navigate that. And so either you didn't live back then and you can kind of get a feeling of how that is, how it was, or you did and you get to retouch on it. And that's true in a lot of books when you go back in time, but I think this book really hit on the nostalgia well, or the feeling of a different time well. But as far as the writing in general, kind of moving on from what's sort of slowly becoming a political and history lesson, but what did we think about the writing style? Like, not necessarily did we like it, did we dislike it, but what about it did we think was interesting? What appealed to us or didn't appeal to us in the style itself? The prose, there's different kinds of writing, like where correspondence is incorporated. Yeah, anybody?
I'll start with the general prose. The letter writing is a whole other conversation. Mm-hmm. But the general prose itself I thought was very striking. It was very well done. And it was one of the things I actually enjoyed most about the novel was the way she experimented with prose. But also, in a sense, I think harkened back to, I don't know if anyone's read this author, but Raymond Carver's style of writing, which is very disassociative, describes things, may not even be relevant to what's going on, but describes the setting around you in a very bleak and almost, again, this disassociative way. So just to give a brief quote, if I may, on page 130, I could see it all so clearly, the traffic lights changing all at night for nobody's benefit, the first cars passing by as the sky grew light, and I was overcome by the sense of how much more there was in his life than in mine, by the things to do and distances to travel, and while I had never done anything or gone anywhere, she goes on and on. But it's a sense of, I'm going to describe the angst of the character through what's going on around. And I thought that was one of my favorite parts of the book. I could go all day on that, but it was, the prose is very striking. It's very haunting, I think is a good word. Did anyone else think that? Or?
Yeah, I did. I remember that scene. I remember enjoying the traffic lights. And she always gets caught up in her own head about what she's thinking about this other person.
Yeah, I enjoyed the prose as well. Recently I read, and Scott read as well, we read an epistolary novel. Over half the novel, or a good half anyways, is in the form of letters between two main characters. The novel had a mixed response in another book club that Scott and I have been to. But those who enjoyed it. I think, admittedly, the extended use of the epistolary form can be off-putting for some people, but here, it's fairly limited such that I feel it complements the main narrative style.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I also enjoyed reading the stylistically, sort of reading the book in general, and it sort of structurally, it sort of felt like a whole series of vignettes, that there wasn't always necessarily a clear overarching storyline, but I think in a sense that was intentional on her part. But one thing I did quite enjoy was the humor in it, and there's a lot of sort of dry witticisms, and I think a lot of satirizing of the academic elite, which Harvard very much represents to an awful lot of people. And I also, I know Batuman is a staff writer and has been for quite a while at The New Yorker, and that has sort of its own style and its own long history of humor writing. And I just wanted to read a couple of examples, one from Batuman's book and one from a short story by Dorothy Parker, who, of course, contributed a lot to The New Yorker, although this example actually wasn't published in The New Yorker. But this was a story, a telephone call, and it's actually a woman waiting for her partner to telephone her and sort of going through into inner turmoil. This is the last time I'll look at the clock. I will not look at it again. It's 10 minutes past 7. He said he would telephone at 5 o'clock. I'll call you at 5, darling. I think that's where he said darling. I'm almost sure he said it there. I know he called me darling twice, and the other time was when he said goodbye. Goodbye, darling. He was busy, and he can't say much in the office, but he called me darling twice. He couldn't have minded me calling him up. I know you shouldn't keep telephoning them. I know they don't like that. When you do that, they know that you are thinking about them and wanting them, and that makes them hate you. All right, and now I'll just give an example from the correspondence that we've already talked about between Celine and the character Ivan. So Ivan and I had settled into a rhythm. He would take a week to write to me, and then I would force myself to wait a week before writing back. This already felt like a huge waste of time. Then 8 days went by and he didn't write, and then it was 10 days, and I was sure he was never going to write to me again, and I was in despair. Finally, he sent a message. The subject line said crazy, which I found encouraging, because that was how I felt. But when I opened the email, it was only one line. My thesis is due in 2 weeks. I will write to you then. I thought, I feel like Dorothy Parker is sort of such a famous figure that she must have been absorbed by Batuman at some stage. I don't think this was like a direct influence on the book, but I think there's sort of that maybe from her experience working with that institution, that maybe
the New Yorker.
Maybe that sort of
similar cadence of humor.
Maybe that sort of worked itself into her own writing style, which has then appeared in the novel here.
Mm-hmm. Well, Scott, you and I can connect to the crazy feeling of the dissertation, am I right?
That's right. Yeah, probably everybody in this room, though, actually. Emily, what about you? Was there anything that struck you about the structure or the form of prose in the book that you found interesting in particular?
Yeah, I really liked the writing style, especially since it just seemed to really flow. Like, you could start reading it, and then you look at the clock, even if you might say you're not going to look at it. And you could see that, like, 2 or 3 hours will have gone by, and you'll have just been reading. And so I really liked the way that it kept going, interspersed with the emails that you get to read, and then also that Russian story as well, which was in there that no one's really brought up yet. And that story was interesting because it kind of mirrored Celine's experience. And so without, like, giving a lot of spoilers away, I really liked how you could read about her story and her thoughts. And then there's a letter, and then it gives you context for then, oh, this is what Ivan's letter said, and now this is how Celine behaves after that. So I did really like how the reading was. I think I read the entire book in, like, 3 days, even though that was about 10 hours of reading. So rapid fire.
I was just going to say, I'm glad we did bring up that Russian class, because for me, that was maybe one of my favorite parts, was the way that she used these different forms of prose. And in particular, I liked the Russian class. I won't give too much away, but I'll just say there was a play that was also performed as a movie that the students could watch that goes over a story. And so then they were, this story was produced by some Russian teachers for the students to go ahead and be able to learn Russian. So as the story progresses, the Russian language becomes more difficult for the students. So that's sort of the guise, that's the formula the author creates for this being in the book. But I think in general, this is kind of, it sort of highlights how, for the main character, Celine, she wants to be a writer, and she sees her own life as trying to be a story, and everything she's doing around in her life right now is story-based. I'm writing, I'm doing correspondence. Oh, here's my life and something similar happening in Russia in the story, in the play. And so I found that very striking, and that's probably, for me, what I found most interesting about the prose.
Mm-hmm. If I may, that's a good point, Scott. I want to pick up on what Emily just mentioned, because you said you read it, Emily, in 3 days,
I think it was 3 or 4.
3 or 4, yes.
Definitely less than a week.
Yes. So Emily's a very ambitious reader. just a little bit of a spoiler for some of our listeners, if you hadn't already discerned that. I think Batuman's The Idiot is interesting, because a lot of novels that I've read have what I would call, like, almost like a takeoff point. And sometimes it could take a while to get to that takeoff point, where it's like, if you've been to a classical symphony orchestra before the symphony or oratorio or whatever is being played, musicians are tuning their instruments, except that only takes a few minutes. But in a novel, sometimes it feels like that tuning up or warming up period can take 100 pages,
yes.
Literally 100 pages. And then
it was 100 pages.
Well, I was going to say, for me in this novel, so maybe not for you, but for me in this novel, I got into it right away. Whereas other novels, sometimes it takes, suddenly about a third of the way through, and suddenly hit that takeoff point where you're like, now I care about the characters, I get the plot, it's starting to make sense. The setting now makes sense to me. I'm here. I'm in it now. And it's no longer laborious to read. Whereas I feel like Batuman's The Idiot, it has that, you hit that comfort zone immediately.
Yeah. I found that too. Like, I definitely got sick of it after probably about 100 pages, but I did feel absorbed right away. Yeah.
I thought it was a bit like with sort of the fragmentary style. It was a bit like hors d'oeuvres. It's like, oh, well, that section was short. I can read another section and another one and another.
Yes.
You just keep going and going.
Yeah.
Because each part doesn't take all that long. Mm-hmm. I mean, often it's like one paragraph or a couple of pages, and then there's a gap.
At least for the first 2/3 or 3/4 of the book, it did feel like the last, she sort of changes her style again to be more of a, just a continuous story in the last season of the book, the summer, which I don't personally get too much into, because again, we don't want to give crazy spoilers for those of you wanting to read at home, but she does, needless to say, change her writing style in the sense that she's not swapping between prose modalities as frequently in that last portion of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that, when we talked more generally before this podcast, that was noticed by several of us, was this sort of, I mentioned how Celine is seeing her life as a story, and part of that is she's a bit disassociated as a protagonist with what's going on around her is a feeling that some of us may have gotten. I was wondering if anybody wanted to speak about that.
Well, another thing that it put me in mind of, which I don't think was really actually an influence that she was drawing from, but Albert Camus' L'Étranger, or I think The Outsider is what
The Stranger.
Or The Stranger. All right. Well, I guess there's been different translations, but anyway, yes, The Stranger. And his protagonist, I mean, it's a much more extreme case of the character, the narrator in The Stranger is, feels very detached from his daily life. And actually, I have one example here I could read. The inciting incident of the novel is that the narrator's mother has died, and he's describing the experience at the wake. It says, "The glare from the white walls was making my eyes smart, and I asked him if he couldn't turn off one of the lamps. Nothing doing, he said. They'd arranged the lights like that. Either one had them all on or not at all. After that, I didn't pay much more attention to him. He went away, brought some chairs, and set them out around the coffin. On one, he placed a coffee pot and 10 or a dozen cups. Then he sat down facing me, on the far side of Mother. The nurse was at the other end of the room, with her back to me. I couldn't see what she was doing, but by the way her arms moved, I guessed that she was knitting. I was feeling very comfortable. The coffee had warmed me up. And through the open door came the scent of flowers." So the point with that is that much of the novel is like that. There's sort of this minute detail of everything the guy is observing and experiencing. And yet you almost, it's almost like the narrative itself is sort of happening in the background. Mm-hmm. And like he's not really connecting with the emotional side of anything. It's just very like physical details and what his physical sensations. And I think that's much more extreme than what we see with Selin. But she also has, she doesn't form strong opinions about much. She just sort of is observing, but not really necessarily
not
feeling.
Connecting.
Or she actually talks about not knowing what to feel about, mm-hmm. about things.
If I may, and yeah, I've felt that. I think all of us, perhaps maybe someone and others, can have that experience. I remember being at an event and thinking, well, normally I really enjoy this, but just, well, you know, sitting there looking around and watching different things happening and feeling more like I was there to observe than to be a participant. And it's interesting feeling of detachment. And so, yeah, I resonated with me in some respects, thinking, okay, I've had this sensation before. I'm not too sure why I'm feeling this right now.
For me, I actually took a different approach to that. I thought this was the dissociation aspect of the prose was one of those metaphorical levels of why the book's called The Idiot. Because there's this moment on page 420 where Selin actually says, "Then something changed. My life no longer seemed like a movie to me." Without getting into spoilers, I'm going to take out a line there. "Nothing extraordinary was happening anymore or would ever happen again." And that's where she kind of makes this realization, well, it's not like a movie. There's other people, there's other things happening around me. And on the notion of this disassociation theme, it was also an obstacle for me reading. I had a lot of time relating to Selin because she had no opinions. She was mm-hmm. dissociative. It was hard. It was like she was a screen to mm-hmm. the book world and understanding the novel.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of stuff happening there.
Right. Yeah, I totally agree with that. That was a big part for me too. Mm-hmm. And Garth, I wonder if it was intended to be a little link, because I remember reading and thinking, wow, this really reminds me of The Stranger. And I hadn't read mm-hmm. The Stranger for like 20 years. I'm old. But I just really, really got that connection too. And The Stranger, you know, he never got to do that in that book for very different reasons, but she does. And then maybe she stops being the idiot.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of developing empathy, would you say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, empathy and self-awareness is not being so special that she's the center of the story.
Okay, at this point, we're going to take a short break. So if you're listening in the podcast version, there's just going to be a quick pause. You can pause yourself if you want to grab a snack, and then we will be back for part two. Hello, and welcome back to GradCast. We are recording our special hashtag bookcast episode of The Idiot, so I will send it over to Scott to introduce our next question.
Yeah, absolutely. And we just finished off talking about disassociation and of the main character to her surroundings, and Megan brought up a really good point that she found it for herself a bit difficult to relate to the character, that there was a relatability issue because of that, because maybe Megan isn't that way. And so that was something I was really interested in general about this character. So I'm not asking right now, like, what did we think about the book overall, but rather what was the relatability to the main character for people, for themselves, and how much does that matter to us as readers?
If I can start, yeah. Scott, for me, I will say part of the relatability, I think, or that issue that I spoke about, part of it comes from the fact that, and is that I've read books, and I do enjoy books that are usually first person, usually young adult, but they don't always have to be, but are usually more, I don't want to say modern either, because that's not really the right word, but they're more YA style, which is more first person. You are in the main character's head. You know exactly what they're thinking, not thinking, or what they might be confused about. And when I was reading The Idiot, I didn't really know Celine like that, like I'm used to reading in other books that I do enjoy. So for me, it might have been a genre issue or type of book issue. And I just kind of wanted to bring that up because I know age-wise, I know YA and that type of style of book is more popular among younger readers right now. Not always, but that is the typical style of which they write characters. Mm-hmm. So for me, that was one thing I wanted to bring up, not to say that it is an age issue, but it might be an obstacle for younger readers or people who like that kind of style of character.
Absolutely. YA is read by all ages, as anybody who is familiar with Harry Potter can attest to, right?
I guess in terms of relatability of the character, in some respects, well, I guess I've already talked about humorous writing, that I sort of identify with that. And sort of, I like to think of myself as having a dry wit. And just sort of the little detailed observations of things, I enjoyed that. She had a fairly broad interest, I think it's fair to say, in terms of the courses she was selecting and the things that she was at least exploring. And that I could certainly relate to. I continue to try to explore areas outside my own specialization a lot. But in terms of her personality, I didn't really see anything of myself in her and her sort of, I don't know, I guess her view of relationships and things was not something I felt I could really identify with much.
There were specific things which I could not relate with. So, for example, or at least not relate with as immediately. So, for example, she took Russian. I've not taken Russian. I'm fairly unilingual. And in case anyone's wondering, English is my unilingual tongue. Aside from that, like when I read fiction, I hear Megan's point about first person, and I do enjoy first person too sometimes. But whenever I read a novel, I read it with a disposition that I'm not even aware of making this choice, but it's a choice I think I routinely make, is to be inherently sympathetic to the narrator. And it's almost like the way I view it is like an effective interview. And I think in an effective interview, generally, 9 times out of 10, the interviewer needs to be sympathetic to the person who's being interviewed and then adopt a sympathetic tone, want to elicit more information, hear the interviewee's perspective. And so I'm taking that approach when I'm reading a novel. I want to learn more. Tell me what's happening. Okay, why'd you do this? Why'd you do that? And I view myself as almost blessed when the narrator chooses to tell me. I mean, obviously, the narrator in this case, Celine, is a work of fiction, but I enjoy that experience. And then however it comes to me, I'm learning more about you and why you did what you did. And this is very interesting to me. And so, like, I view myself as inherently sympathetic to narrators. Even when the narrator is only telling you certain things. Because we ourselves, like, you know, this is not, you know, we don't view most of our friendships as a confessional booth. And so we tend not to tell even our best friends our deepest, darkest secrets. And there's a lot happening sometimes. And I see a little bit in this novel, we're not being told everything. And that's okay. But sometimes it, you know, like, there are other novels where you have, let's say, where the narrator may not be such a good person after all, and you have a bit of a deceptive narrator, a narrator who's telling you very carefully only certain things because the narrator wants you to have a favorable impression of them, because otherwise, if you knew the whole story, the narrator could actually be a murderer or something. Now, that's not the case here. And so, as I say, like, I revert to my usual standard position, which is to view the narrator with inherent sympathy and empathy, and I want to know more.
That makes me think of some Agatha Christie there.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Wouldn't it have been a twist though if she did end up being a murderer?
Yeah,
that's the epilogue.
Yes.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's kind of like, well, you're talking about how things are being left out. Like it doesn't To me, it never felt like she was holding anything back. She's fairly forthright, and yet you do sort of feel like it isn't all there.
Yeah.
That something is being sort of like Citizen Kane, like you get to the end of the movie and you're like not sure you really actually know the guy any better.
No spoilers for the book, but spoilers for Citizen Kane. No. So, yeah, that's true. It is an interesting thing because I kind of feel the same way. I've not been as empathetically aware as maybe Mark that I do that. I do think I do that some, but it is definitely true that I think throughout the book and with many characters in general, the authors hold back the full story. I don't think it's always, I think in this case it might have been intentional. I don't think it's always intentional, but it's almost most of the time unavoidable because mm-hmm. they're trying to think in a character voice and that's something natural that they do. As far as for myself with relatability, I don't relate super strongly with her, but I do relate in the sense that all of us in this room probably do. We're all mm-hmm. students. We all are really attached to academia. We went past undergrad, so we're doing that. We're even past Celine at this point. So in that way, I'm able to identify. And so I think it's in that context I identify most, not just in that I'm like, oh, I love undergrad, but actually how I identify with her viewing her life as a story. I sometimes, when I'm getting really involved in my research and the different directions I could go in academia, because it's such a broad thing, it's such huge choices, I have to think about, okay, which things am I choosing because I'm truly interested in this research, and which things am I doing because I think this would make a better overall feeling of who I am as a research scientist. And I think there's a lot of people who maybe can approach things and have to find out, wait, what parts are most important to me about what we do? And you could probably relate that to any form of life, but that's how I relate to it myself. Mm-hmm. Amelie, how did you feel about the relatability of the character?
I could not relate to the character at all. Just because there's a huge personality difference between me and Celine. Like, she'd be like staying up till 4 a.m. and not going to class and not knowing how she feels and not knowing what her opinions are. And I don't know what that's like to not have an opinion. I feel like I'm bursting with opinions and feelings and ideas all the time. And so I agree with what you said, Mark, how you're kind of rooting for the main character. And in a sense, the main character is you, mm-hmm. right? Like, especially when it's written in first person, but even when it's not. And so all the choices that she was making, I wanted to say, stop, you're doing the wrong thing. Like, go to sleep, go to class, mm-hmm. forget about Ivan. And so I found myself getting very frustrated with Celine and saying, like, I want you to do everything differently. And so while I enjoyed, like, experiencing a different way of thinking, because every time you read, you become more empathetic, right? You're experiencing something through someone else's eyes, mm-hmm. which is something you really don't get unless you read, which is another opinion that I have. But I didn't relate to her at all, and I wanted to help her. I related way more to her friend Svetlana. And when I said this before, Scott knows me well, and he was like, yep, that is who you are.
Yeah, I responded to you, and I think that's a good point, Emily. And about the poor choices, maybe not so much you. I think all of us perhaps can relate to her making some poor choices.
Yes.
And maybe she's just compounding them a little bit. But I have some experience working in the hospitality industry, and it can be...
Oh, I thought you were going to say, I have some experience poor choices.
That's you. But I'm putting this a little more euphemistically in the hospitality industry. It's interesting because talking to somebody who may, let's say, have an addiction problem or whatever, and then people talk about them as if they're not human, but then, you know, when you talk to somebody who may have, not that everyone does, but some people do, and when you're talking to somebody, you think, wow, this person, but then when you actually get engaged with them, you're like, holy smokes, this person's really smart. And then you realized, okay, and it's not so much that he had necessarily a whole bunch of bad choices, but at one, although maybe now in recent years they do, but at some point maybe something happened, mm-hmm. and that suddenly pushed them, you know, off track. And and it's like, okay. And it's like, oh, suddenly I realized now after hearing you for a few minutes, something happened in the past, and now all your bad choices since then suddenly make sense to me.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I wanted to comment on something that Amelie just said as well, and that was just that about empathy, which Mark brought up initially. And how when you read and you identify with another character, you grow empathy. And I just think that's a really interesting thought. And actually, I did read an article in Psychology Today, I think it was, where there was research done, can't quote it right now, but basically that they found that people who are consistent readers of fiction versus those who only choose to read nonfiction tend to have much higher scores in empathy and development than that part of the brain. And they say, they believe, the working hypothesis is that it has to do with the fact that they're having to do what you just described, Emily, put themselves in another person's mindset and shoes. So you're being sympathetic or empathetic, like Mark described, and I think you're working and living in it, sometimes potentially painfully so, if you're not enjoying their relatability. And so the second part of that question, I think most people answered it, but Emily, just how important, since you had sort of the most disconnection with relatability, I think it's good to ask you, how important is that relatability in a novel to you in it, as far as enjoying it or not?
That's a good question. I've definitely read tons of books where I am nothing like the main character. That's not a requirement for me to read a book. But I think that because this character could have been me, like I was an undergrad at one point, she could, like I could have been her. And so it was more important for me that it was more frustrating when she didn't do the right thing. I wanted to help her more. Whereas if I read a book about like an astronaut, I'm not an astronaut. I don't really care what astronauts do. I'm just along for the ride. So maybe because this hits a little bit closer to home, it was more important for me that I related to her more.
I'm hearing that you actually maybe it wasn't the first thing you thought, but it almost sounds to me like you cared about Celine.
I did. Yeah. I definitely did. Yeah. No, I cared about her. I was frustrated by her. I don't think we could have been friends, but I cared about her. Yeah.
So that leads me to the last kind of thing I want to talk to you all about, and that's sort of what was everybody's overall opinion about the book? Like, if you gave it a brief, like, this is what I think about the book overall, now that we've talked about more of the details, what would that be?
I can appreciate the writing, the prose, and even the story from an academic's perspective. I did not, let's say, care as much for this book as maybe others have. I found it, like, I found it hard to relate to the main character, and while I can appreciate many of the story's elements, I did find it hard to get into. I did not get that takeoff point right immediately in the book. It was very difficult for me to get into, and that's just how I feel. But that said, I can appreciate a lot of different aspects about it, and I will say that it has great prose, a very interesting main character, we'll say, once you get past the smoke screen of disassociation, and an interesting, if not dysfunctional, love story.
Yeah.
So my overall feeling, it's definitely not something I would read again, let's put it that way, and I'm not feeling keen to seek out more of Badabun's work. I know she's actually written another novel that's a direct sequel to this one that's about Celine's sophomore year. But I like the first 100 pages I liked.
and that's 420 pages or something.
what frustrated me the most was I felt that the whole Ivan thing really began to take over.
It did.
After
yeah.
that,
you don't
point.
Like Ivan.
And
hate him.
So much of her time is he keeps cropping up incessantly and
like a parasite.
Right.
And I felt like it just his presence to me subsumed a lot of what I enjoyed in the first part. I felt like we were hearing less about what her actual classes were, less about we were getting less commentary on Harvard itself and more her just thinking about Ivan.
Yeah.
And so that it kind of turned into something else for me, and I didn't enjoy it nearly as much past about 100 pages.
You know, for me, I think I had a similar experience because so with Ivan, you start disliking him a lot. But then one thing I'll say is I found for myself towards that end when I said the writing style changed as well, a lot of little things change. She goes out somewhere else. You start, at least for me, didn't dislike him quite as much. He became more normal. And I wonder if that was intentional. I also wonder if like going away from the classes and that sort of thing a bit and writing was intentional. Maybe that's one of the ways she's being an idiot. She's focusing less on what she's there for. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But with you mentioned something Mark brought up, Megan, which was the takeoff point. And I was like Mark, I found that I was able to take off right away with that first email thing that you talked about. What I found the problem was, as far as there was no the landing point
yes.
was my yeah, issue. Yeah. I feel like there was a landing point and the pilot just went right past it and didn't get down there. And so it kind of just kept going. And it could have been an interesting enough story towards the end. You know, maybe if I read it again, if I did that, I'd find something else with it. But what I will say is I did like the beginning of it. And I'd say I liked it more than the first 100 pages myself. I liked the first like two-thirds, three-quarters quite a bit. And I liked the book quite a lot overall. And I liked it for that different modalities of writing. And it created a lot of discussion amongst us.
Yeah, it certainly did. And I think the question of enjoying and not enjoying is a very complicated question. So, for example, one of my favorite authors is P.D. James. He's written a lot of, and it's kind of interesting because if you ever see an interview of her, whether on TV or on YouTube, she's a very proper, and she has a very aristocratic manner, and just a very gentle lady. And you know, imagine her drinking tea on a Sunday afternoon, and then you think of her fiction, it's like, and it's like, oh, you shouldn't be reading that, let alone writing it.
Well, I mean, she was like a coroner or something, wasn't she?
Yeah, she. Well, that's just it. She was a coroner, so she'd had some exposure to darker aspects of life that I can only imagine, or I care not to imagine. But it's interesting. So, for example, like she wrote a lot of detective fiction, mystery fiction, murder fiction, and that, for my mind, now. Agatha Christie, you do enjoy that type of dark fiction.
Yeah.
Whereas P.D. James, it's just dark. And but it's well written, but it's dark. You don't necessarily, oh, I'm having a lot of fun reading this. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, and then what happened? And then no, you don't necessarily, it's not an experience to enjoy per se, but it is still stimulating. And I think especially of her novel, The Children of Men, which is a dystopian novel. It's deeply disturbing, but it's also one of my favorite novels. Do I enjoy it? Well, it's like, I don't, it's not one of my favorite novels because I enjoy it. It's one of my favorite novels precisely because I don't enjoy it.
Perhaps the word appreciate. How much do I appreciate the book would be a better descriptor of my question.
I think that would be, now in the case of this book, I actually do enjoy most of it. But Scott, I really appreciate how you took my takeoff point and then you commented on there's no landing point or the pilot missed landing point, because I feel like a novel could have wrapped up around circa 380 pages and probably wound up a lot more tightly. So overall, yes, I enjoyed it. I appreciate the writing, and I feel like it was a great novel overall.
Great. Emily.
I hated it. But that said, so as I was reading it in the like three or four days, I kept saying like, oh, the stupid book club book that I hate. And then my husband was like, you know, you read a lot of books and you have talked way more about this one than like any book you've read in the last year. So like, even though he wasn't reading it, I would be like this, but listen to this. Or I'd be like this. And I'd go on a little rant as we were walking the dog. So even though I hated it, it sparked a lot of discussion like in my home life. And with this book club, like I can see how this would be a good book for a book club, because it really got you thinking. It put yourself in her shoes. There was a lot in there. And so even though I didn't enjoy it, I'm glad that I read it.
Mm. It's sometimes, if I may just really briefly, it's sometimes noted by some that the best book club book is not one that everyone enjoys.
Yes.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think maybe my last question I want to have is for Megan directly. I wanted to ask you, what portion of the book would you say was your favorite?
Oh, hands down, the last half where she's in Hungary. That was like my travel fiction. I was like, oh, I can get into this book now. And then it ended.
Right. So the reason why I asked that was, I think you, listening at home, you can hear, there's a lot of complex thoughts and emotions about this book. And like Amelie just said, it really makes you think and discuss. And you're going to be affected by it one way or another. And hey, we had several people who loved it. Other people were like, eh, some who hated it. And we have the fact that, the ones who of us liked it, half of us were like, we really like the beginning. That's the good part. And here Megan's like, you know, the end. So I think, is it good? Will you appreciate it? Will you like it? As with so many things, but especially with The Idiot, I think you need to read it yourself. And we'd love to hear your comments on our socials.
This has been GradCast, the official radio show and podcast of the Society of Graduate Students at Western University. I've been co-host number one, Emily Hutchinson, along with Scott Walters, Mark Ambrosio, Garth Casborn, and Megan Vole. We've been doing a hashtag bookcast episode of Elif Batuman's The Idiot, and this episode was produced by me, Emily Hutchinson. If you'd like to be involved with the show or get in contact with us, send us an email at gradcast@sogs.ca. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, TikTok at GradCast Radio. To listen to us, we're on Radio Western 94.9 FM on Tuesday and Thursday, and you can find all of our episodes wherever you find your podcasts. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day.